Hi, this is Stephanie with the Herald Review for Wednesday, October 11th. We'll begin on the front page with the story headlined, Students Explore Opportunities After High School. More than 1,000 high school students from 10 area schools converged Tuesday on the soccer field inside the Decatur Indoor Sports Center for a one-stop shop to learn about career and college opportunities. The annual Decatur Area College and Career Fair, co-sponsored by Richland Community College and Millikan University, united more than 65 in-state and out-of-state colleges, technical schools, armed forces, and resource services who set up shop to introduce themselves to the curious students. It's one of those places where you don't know what you want to do or what college you want to go to. You stop here and can talk to them, said John Oliver, Career Service Coordinator at Richland. Andrew Fuchs brought a unique perspective to the recruiting table as he was one of the few representatives set up to talk to students about opportunities available outside of college. As the apprenticeship coordinator for the Plumbers and Steamfitters Local 137, Fuchs said there is a need for those in well-paying trade jobs that only require several years of a free apprenticeship. At least one student Fuchs spoke with didn't know what an apprentice was, which he said underscored the need to get his message out. He said he's seen a number of young people go off to college because they felt obligated, then leave after a year or so with tens of thousands of dollars in student debts. When the building trades got removed from most of the curriculums at the high school level, a lot of them do not know about the jobs or the opportunities, said Fuchs, who brought along a virtual simulator that allowed students to try their hand at welding. If we had been exposed to them on the front end, they could have tried this and be earning a living without that debt. Among those reaching out to the students were Barton Jennings and Honey Zimmerman, both of whom teach supply chain management at Western Illinois University. Described by Jennings as an invisible growth industry, the two spoke to students about the importance of the industry here in Decatur, especially with existing companies like Archer Daniels Midland Company and Caterpillar Inc., as well as the push by city and county leaders to develop Decatur's road and rail infrastructure into a transportation hub. Even if students have never considered the concept of a supply chain, Zimmerman said it is something that impacts everyone, whether they're getting groceries or ordering something from Amazon. No matter what their interests are, there is something there for them in the supply chain, said Zimmerman, an assistant professor of supply chain management. While most of those at the event represented colleges across the Midwest, Oliver said he wanted students to consider all their options as they prepare to graduate high school. It's not for me to say to go to college, but I think it's our responsibility to tell young people to get some kind of training beyond high school, he said. Our next story is titled Swapping Books for Interaction. Dentist students benefit from team, hands-on learning activities. Deswan Smith took his assignment to heart. The task was to take on the personality of a person living in Civil War times and write and deliver a eulogy for a famous figure of the time. Deswan, an eighth grader at Dennis School, drew the task of delivering a eulogy for Dorothea Dix in the voice of a Civil War nurse. Dennis School uses project-based learning methods since becoming a lab school in partnership with Millikan University in 2011. Millikan uses a similar method with its students. The idea is to provide hands-on learning that gives students the power over their own education and offers opportunities to do real-world projects and learn skills that can be applied to real life. Deswan found Dix's accomplishments are many, from creating a model school for girls to crusading for humane treatment of mental patients in asylums. Dix, Deswan said in character, was fearless. She told me she was not afraid to speak her mind, he said. She did what nurses should do. And he didn't forget one thing that most of the other students did forget, the gathering for food and visiting after the funeral. Please join me after the service as we say goodbye to our dear friend, he finished. Deswan said students at Dennis drew from a hat to determine their character and the person they were to eulogize, and they could try to trade with a classmate if they wanted a different person. But he buckled down and did his research, he said, and tried to figure out what a colleague would have said about Dix at her funeral. Dennis teacher Keith Creighton told students doing the eulogies that he wanted them to look for qualities and characteristics that were admirable, even if the character reading the eulogy and the famous figure might not have seen eye to eye. If you looked at a person who wasn't that great of a guy and did things that are questionable in history, we're still the beneficiaries of that, he said. Students have project-based learning classes twice a week, said Aaliyah Houston, and another set of projects underway required the students to choose a community organization and figure out ways to help. Her group is researching the Red Cross and its aid to hurricane victims. If the whole class should decide on the Red Cross, they'll all work together on that one project, or they could decide on different organizations, and small groups will each pursue their own project. One feature of project-based learning is that students work with other students at other grade levels. It makes friendships stronger and we make new friends, said Aaliyah, who's in 7th grade. A member of her group is Kyla Crutchfield, who's in 8th grade. We meet people we don't know anything about, and we get to know each other's strengths and weaknesses, and we learn about each other. In another part of the building, students use the produce from the garden that Dennis shares with Milliken to create healthy dishes and learn about cooking. Haley Snuffer, an 8th grader, joked about how her fellow group members don't listen because they're boys, but making healthy food is a passion of hers. I love to cook, she said. And learning new ways to use the food they've grown themselves, she said, is also a way to help the community. The students can create recipes and offer them to people who want to learn to eat healthier foods, too. With this story is a box that describes project-based learning in a little bit more depth. It says, the goal of project-based learning is to keep students engaged in their education, emphasizing real-world problem-solving skills. It begins with content-rich ideas, opportunity to learn through inquiry and discovery. Activities are generally collaborative, mastery of content must be demonstrated, and students direct their own learning to the final outcome. We also have a state government story on page one, headlined Illinois Bills in Payment Limbo, Obligations Worth Billions Yet to Be Processed. This is Dateline Springfield. Illinois is chasing a moving target as it tries to dig out of the nation's worst budget crisis, and a review obtained by the Associated Press shows $7.5 billion worth of unpaid bills, as much as half the total, hadn't been sent to the official who writes the checks by the end of June. Although many of those IOUs have since been paid, a similar amount in unprocessed bills has replaced them in the last 3 months, Comptroller Susana Mendoza's office said Monday. That's in addition to $9 billion worth of checks that are at the office but being delayed because the state lacks the money to pay them. The mound of past due bills tripled over the 2 years Republican Governor Bruce Rauner and Democrats who control the General Assembly were locked in a budget stalemate, which ended in July when lawmakers hiked income taxes over Rauner's vetoes. In some cases, agencies were waiting to send their receipts to Mendoza because lawmakers haven't approved the spending. For example, the Department of Corrections had $471 million in unpaid bills on hand as of June 30th, largely for that reason. Ascertaining the precise nature of the state's past due obligations and liabilities is an essential component of responsible cash and debt management, the Democratic comptroller wrote in a letter to Republican Representative David McSweeney, a budget hawk from Barrington Hills who requested the review. Mendoza and McSweeney plan to use the findings to urge lawmakers to override Rauner's veto of legislation that would require monthly reporting of bills not yet submitted for processing. The measure, authored by Mendoza's office, would include a breakdown of how old each bill is and which ones have received legislative approval to be paid. The governor supports more transparency on the state of our finances, Rauner spokesman Hud Engelhart said in an email to AP. He vetoed this bill because the state does not have adequate technology in place to cost-effectively provide this information monthly. The age of bills is important because many are 90 days or older, and face a 1% per month late payment fee. About $5.5 billion of the current $15.9 billion backlog is subject to the penalty. Mendoza estimates the state will ultimately pay $900 million in late payment fees on the existing pile of debt. The Department of Central Management Services, which handles personnel, procurement, and employee health care, has most of the June 30th bundle with $5.8 billion. That's mostly doctors' bills owed to employee medical providers under the state group health insurance plan. McSweeney's call for the overview coincided with the current October 1st deadline for publicizing the amount of bills held at agencies at a fiscal year's end. McSweeney said with Illinois swimming in debt, including a $130 billion shortfall in what's needed to pay employee pensions and other long-term borrowing, check writers need more exact information. With a $16 billion backlog of unpaid bills and $200 billion in total liabilities, when you add in the pension debt, I don't trust this governor, I don't trust this administration, McSweeney said. We need monthly reporting. Typically, when a governor and legislature agree on a budget, the legislation authorizing it includes appropriations bills. If money is spent that isn't approved, lawmakers must do it after the fact in a supplemental appropriation. Rauner has complained that the budget legislative Democrats approved in July is $1.7 billion short of being balanced. Democrats have countered that the governor spent money last year that wasn't approved. Neither side has elaborated. Democrats have signaled they plan to attack Rauner's budget management during his 2018 re-election campaign. Mendoza, who beat Rauner's handpicked candidate in a special election for comptroller last fall, has wrangled with the governor over issues related to the deficit and the backlog, including one spat over which fund to use to pay particular bills. The legislature returns for its fall session October 24th. Moving now to the local and state page, we have a story headlined, Give a Coat, Warm a Kid. Annual campaign seeks to outfit thousands in needs. This is Dateline Decatur. A winter coat can cost $50 to $200 depending on type and style, which can create a burden for many Macon County families. The 26th annual Coats for Kids drive is scheduled to begin today and run through November 30th. Dove Inc. and WAND-TV host the collection drive and request new or used outerwear in good condition. On average, more than 2,000 coats are distributed to the community because of the coat drive, said Barb Blakely, Director of Volunteers and Community Relations with Dove. The drive aims to help families in need in a city where, U.S. Census figures show, one in four residents lived in poverty as of 2015. At locations around the county, Dove accepts coats of all sizes and types, Blakely said. Sizes for second graders to sixth graders are often in high demand, she said. Kids come in all shapes and sizes, so all sizes of coats are a good fit, she said. They appreciate all types of outerwear as well, from heavy winter coats to jackets and raincoats, Blakely said. It is disheartening to see a child without a coat or trying to get by with a couple sweatshirts, she said. As soon as donations start coming in, agencies will begin passing them out, Blakely said. Each participating clothing room offers different sizes and hours, she said. Some may only have children's coats, while others will have adult sizes as well. The Northeast Community Fund gives out the majority of the coats, Blakely said. Director Jerry Pels said the nonprofit agency at 825 North Water Street distributes more than 1,000 coats each year. It's very beneficial for our clients who come in here to be able to have access to this kind of a quality product. These are warm, clean, a lot of them just look very like new when they come back to the cleaners, he said. They will put out the lighter coats and jackets first, and then the heavy coats as it gets colder, Pels said, because outerwear is often an immediate need. It's a great idea and something we need in this community, Pels said. This is a fantastic blessing to this community that Dove does this. Other clothing rooms that receive the coats are Dove's at Prairie Avenue Christian Church, Antioch Baptist Church, New Life Pregnancy Center, the Salvation Army, and Reasonable Service. Dry cleaners make sure the coats are in good shape and clean before handing them out, Blakely said. Classic Cleaner, Peerless Cleaners, Pride Cleaners, and Launderers, Waits Dry Cleaners and Launderers are participating in the drive. Right now it is gorgeous, and when you are really needing them, it is too late. We want to get them in the clothing room before they need them, Blakely said. For more information, contact Dove at 217-428-6616. Next up, we have a story from Mattoon, headlined Toledo to get YMCA facility. Project a natural fit for Mattoon Y, Neal Foundation. A two-story, $4 million recreation facility is set for construction in Toledo, about 22 miles southeast of Mattoon in Cumberland County. The 33,000-square-foot Neal Center will be constructed on an empty lot at 130 Courthouse Square at the northeast corner of the square. Mattoon YMCA senior advisor Tony Sparks said the work will take about 12 months. The Neal Center is slated to offer an indoor pool, a full gym and half gym, indoor walking and jogging track, fitness studios, wellness center, child watch room, multipurpose and youth room, and lobby. We are certainly very excited about bringing the YMCA's programs and services to the community of Cumberland County. We believe we can be a great asset, said Mattoon YMCA CEO Blake Fairchild. He added that the Neal Center could host aquatic programs, summer camps, youth sports, and more. We are looking forward to the opportunity to expand our services beyond the Mattoon area. Sparks said Neal Center members will be able to use the Mattoon facility, and Mattoon YMCA members will be able to use the Toledo facility. He said Neal Center members also will be able to use the Mattoon YMCA's access agreement with Sarah Bush Lincoln's Center for Healthy Living. We have quite a few folks from Cumberland County who belong to the YMCA. It just seems like a natural fit, Sparks said. The Mattoon YMCA reported that the Neal Center has been made possible by the estate of Burnham Neal, who died in 2012. Neal, a Toledo native, owned the Neal Tire and Auto Service Company that his family founded and was a philanthropist. The Neal Foundation administers the estate, and Neal Center Inc. has led local planning efforts for a recreation center in Toledo for several years. Neal Center Inc. board member Greg Irvin said Burnham Neal had long wanted Toledo to have a recreation center with an indoor pool. Irvin said Neal Center Inc. had a construction plan, but did not have experience managing such a facility, so they sought input from the Mattoon YMCA. He said these talks eventually led to a joint venture with the Mattoon YMCA. The Mattoon YMCA will be an excellent partner, said Irvin, who plans to join the YMCA board alongside other Neal Center Inc. board members. Irvin said the Neal Center will serve residents of Toledo and other Cumberland County communities and will potentially draw residents from neighboring Clark and Jasper counties. He said Sarah Bush Lincoln could eventually use the Neal Center to bring fitness programs closer to patients in these counties. In addition, Irvin said having YMCA services available in Toledo could help bring new residents and businesses to Toledo. He said the Neal Center will help complete a series of building improvements on the Courthouse Square that has recently included construction of a new Sarah Bush Lincoln Clinic and a Toledo fire station. The Neal Center's exterior has been designed to resemble the look of the courthouse. Fairchild said the Mattoon YMCA plans to start offering charter membership opportunities soon for the Neal Center. Sparks added that they plan to hold a public meeting sometime in November at Cumberland High School to share additional information about the project. We want to make sure the folks in Toledo know we are all about community. We certainly want to engage with the various community groups that exist and find ways to strengthen Cumberland County, Sparks said. Next up, we have a story headlined, Central Illinois' Front Row Seat to Fall Foliage. This is part of the 100 Reasons to Love the Decatur Area series that the Herald and Review is doing. Each day listing a reason the Decatur region is loved, profiling people, places, and history that are special to the region and that make it a great place to live. This is the prime time of year for one of nature's greatest spectacles in Central Illinois, the changing of the leaves. Our region offers numerous natural vistas and undulating landscapes to see the fall shades. Some of the best views are along Lake Decatur, the Fort Daniel Conservation Area near Mount Zion, Fairview Park in Decatur, and the Allerton Park and Retreat Center in Monticello. But there are many more. The big changeover usually picks up in the second week of October. Further north, it happens in late September. In southern Illinois, it's early November. Central Illinois tends to get lots of colors because of two factors, starting with the sheer diversity of species. We're home to the sugar maples, flowering dogwoods, and red oaks that produce rich bronzes and orange shades. Cottonwoods, ash, birch, and hickory tend to create bright orange and yellow tints. Even the pesky poison ivy gets in on the game. It can have brilliant hues. Our region's varying weather is a big part of the color burst. Lots of summer rain means healthy trees and lots of pigments. Sunny skies in late summer and early autumn tend to make for more vibrant reds, yellows, and oranges. The bad news for us is that drought conditions can mean leaves don't change at all. This will become more apparent in coming weeks as chlorophyll production slows down. The spectacle usually wraps by mid-November, and then all the raking begins. Next up, a story headlined, Waters Pleads Innocent to Murder. This is Dateline Decatur. Ryan D. Waters, accused of being part of a plot to rob and murder a man in Decatur who wanted to buy drugs, entered a plea of not guilty Tuesday in Macon County Circuit Court. Waters, 20, is charged with four counts of first-degree murder, but denies his alleged role in the shooting death of 22-year-old Zachary Hubbert of Windsor. Prosecutors have said Hubbert wanted to buy cannabis and was lured to Decatur on August 27th on the pretext he would be able to purchase the drug. Police found his dead body in an empty house in the 1200 block of East Condit Street. He had been shot multiple times. Waters is accused of being part of the deception, meeting with Hubbert while pretending he had cannabis for sale. The Macon County State's Attorney's Office said Waters was present when Hubbert was shot to death by another Decatur man, Jason A. White, 27. White is also pleading not guilty to murder charges. Waters, who is being held in custody, appeared before Judge Phoebe S. Bowers in a gray-striped Macon County jail jumpsuit. Through his attorney, Monica Hawkins, Waters said he wished to waive his right to a preliminary hearing that would have determined whether there had been probable cause for his arrest. You wish to waive that right today and plead not guilty and set your case over for a pretrial hearing? Is that what you wish to do? Asked the judge. Yes, ma'am, Waters replied. That pretrial hearing is now set for November 20th. Waters remains in custody. Our next story is man pleads not guilty to obstruction, evidence lacking for more serious charge. A Decatur man is pleading not guilty to an obstruction of justice charge that said he lied to police about his identity after officers burst into a hotel room and found him in bed with a naked 15-year-old girl. The case against Kirsten L. Turner, 24, came up for a pretrial hearing Tuesday in Macon County Circuit Court, where Turner, who is being held in the Macon County Jail, was represented by defense attorney Timothy Tai. Tai told Judge Thomas Griffith he was ready to proceed with the case, and it was then set for a disposition hearing Friday. Sworn affidavits said Turner had been arrested at 5 a.m. July 30th after members of the U.S. Marshals Fugitive Task Force entered his room at the Baymont Inn in Forsyth. Turner was being sought on warrants related to earlier charges alleging domestic abuse. The police had described the room as having liquor and a scattering of ecstasy pills on a nightstand. A breath test showed the girl had alcohol in her system, according to the documents. In an adjoining room, police found a naked 17-year-old girl, unresponsive, and it was later determined she had a cocktail of multiple illegal drugs in her body and was taken to hospital for treatment, the documents said. Police said Turner initially gave them the name of his brother, but was soon found out after officers obtained a photograph of him. He initially was booked on additional charges of endangering the life of a child and contributing to the delinquency of a minor. Macon County State's Attorney Jay Scott said Tuesday those charges had not been proceeded with because there was not enough evidence to meet the legal standard to support them. Another man, Marquess T. Little, also faces charges of supplying drugs in connection with the hotel incident. A warrant has been issued for his arrest, and police are searching for him. Next, we have a couple of briefs, the first from Decatur, Shorts Drop Drugs. A traffic stop led to the arrest of a 35-year-old man who police say was hiding a bag containing nearly 15 grams of crystal meth inside his shorts. A sworn police affidavit said the man was pulled over Friday for improper lane usage near East Locust and 22nd Streets. During the stop, a canine alerted the officer and detective at the scene to the presence of drugs, according to the affidavit. The man was searched, and the affidavit said an anomaly was felt in the region of his buttocks. Shortly after, the bag of drugs fell out of the bottom of his shorts and field tested positive for methamphetamine. The man faces a preliminary charge of manufacturing or delivering between 5 and 15 grams methamphetamine, which is subject to review by the state's attorney's office. He was held in the Macon County Jail on Tuesday and is due in court on November 14th. Next, from Vandalia, Stop Nets Heroin Haul. A 37-year-old California man was arrested Sunday after troopers seized $960,000 worth of heroin in his Dodge Caravan during a traffic stop, Illinois State Police said Tuesday. In a media release, Trooper Tammy Wellborn said a trooper patrolling Interstate 70 east of Vandalia initiated the stop at about 8:10 a.m. The trooper pulled the driver over because he was speeding, she said, and during a search of the vehicle, about 6 pounds of heroin was discovered inside. The driver was arrested and held in the Fayette County Jail on Sunday on the preliminary charges of possession of a controlled substance and controlled substance trafficking. Now let's move to the Herald and Review's opinion page. There's an editorial headlined, Roger Walker's Legacy Remains Consistent, Sturdy. Roger E. Walker Jr.'s legacy today remains precisely what it was 5 years ago. While his accomplishments were plenty, what he is remembered for is the people he touched. We remember and commemorate Walker again as the sign naming a section of Illinois 48 the Sheriff Roger E. Walker Jr. Memorial Road. A public celebration of the signage will be Friday, November 3rd. Walker was the first black sheriff elected in Illinois history and director of the Illinois Department of Corrections from 2003 to 2009. He was known for building consensus, and he devoted much of his life to making Decatur and Macon County a better place. He died in 2012 at the age of 63, but that's a mere fragment of the story. The things said about Walker have been consistent. Those who encountered the man, and there were thousands, described him in remarkably similar ways during his life, immediately after his passing, and even now, 5 years after his death. He knew how to treat people, how to talk to others. He could deal with just about anybody in any kind of circumstances. He was honest to a fault, hardworking, and a true friend to all he met. I hated going to lunch with him. He would talk to everyone in the restaurant. He just loved to talk to people. He's one of the most remarkable citizens Illinois has ever seen and had run for public office. There aren't many people who receive a handful of those type of comments, let alone the torrent that results any time Walker's name is mentioned. Following the May announcement of the naming honor, Walker's nephew, Shaylen Walker, said, to hear all these people talk about him. There are so many people who he'll live forever in their hearts. He's still a pillar within our family. His name will always bring all of us together. We don't need a section of road named after Roger Walker Jr. to remember him. As Shailen Walker points out, he'll live forever in the hearts of so many, but we need the section named so we can think of him on a regular basis and do our best to emulate his best. Here's a story out of Chicago, headlined Soliciting Murder on Social Media, Woman Accused of Threatening FBI Mole in Train Guns Case. A suburban Chicago mother of seven is accused of urging Facebook followers to kill a gang member turned FBI mole for his role in a sting that put an associate of hers behind bars on charges he tried to sell semi-automatic rifles stolen from a freight train, court documents show. Aisha Stanciel, 38, faces federal cyber-stalking charges for the threats, as well as a gun charge, after she was arrested carrying a bag containing one of the brand-new AR-15-type assault rifles stolen from the Chicago train that had stopped overnight at a Norfolk Southern yard on September 18, 2016, according to a federal complaint examined by the Associated Press this week. Authorities have never publicly announced any arrests related to the theft of the six new Smith & Wesson-made M&P assault rifles and 27 pistols, despite Stanciel's indictment in May, and the arrest in October 2016 of Brian Stafford, who allegedly told the informant he had the rifles just 2 days after the train theft. That 2016 theft angered residents near the Southside Rail Yard because it came a year after the theft of 104 Sturm, Ruger, and Co. guns, which quickly fell into the hands of gangs. After the 2015 heist, aldermen sought assurances from Norfolk Southern that such thefts wouldn't happen again. At a sentencing hearing last week in that 2015 case, Judge John Tharp said criminals prize new guns because they're hard to trace and that their theft contributed to an epidemic of violence in Chicago. A prosecutor told the court there's a little-known subculture of thieves who regularly rob trains in the nation's busiest rail hub. It was Stafford's arrest that led Stanciel, just days later, to start posting the Facebook threats that included the informant's name, court papers said. We'll close out this part with a story from the Your Money page. This is the Stu Ellis column, A Clean Bean Field, No Longer. Growing up, I was my father's main weapon against weeds, particularly in soybeans. Miles and miles of soybean rows flowed underfoot. Uncountable thousands of weeds fell under blows from a hoe or a jerk of the weed hook. And after some long drinks of real lemonade from an old metal thermos, a clean field was a badge of hard work. Then in the late 1960s, herbicides arrived on Rural Route 1, and the anti-weed weapons were retired, in some respect. But that was a gradual process, as learning the timing and application rates were a work in progress. And in the mid-1990s, when Monsanto introduced Roundup Ready soybeans to complement its glyphosate herbicide, soybean fields were clean for nearly a decade and a half, until weed resistance defeated technology. As a result, soybean fields will have visible weeds. Weeds in corn are either shaded out or hidden by the taller vegetation, but soybean fields will remain the barometer of weed control. And agriculture may have to reset the normal indicator on the barometer. That will be a psychological nightmare to older farmers, and particularly to non-farming landowners. And it may be a welcome relief to the younger farming generation, which has neither the technology for a killing spray on every weed, nor the time to walk every row of thousands of acres of soybeans. The times are changing, and this year's experiment with a new generation of dicamba herbicide and dicamba-resistant soybeans may become a major step in that change. While companies such as Monsanto, BASF, and DowDuPont invested hundreds of millions of dollars to promote and market their new formulations, there's a chance that the two-year experiment will be unplugged by the EPA after the 2018 growing season. That depends on whether corporate damage control can outweigh farmers and university-based weed scientists who have totally different viewpoints on how to resolve the non-target spray drift issues. If Monsanto's X-Tendimax, BASF's Engenia, and DowDuPont's Fexapan become a footnote in the annals of the Weed Science Society of America, it will be seen as one last gasp in an expensive attempt to retain weed-free soybean fields as the standard of American agriculture. If the experiment fails, Corn Belt farmers will revert to other strategies for fighting yield-reducing weeds. After all, who wants to spend money on crop nutrients and have weeds steal the food from the cash crop, along with whatever moisture may happen to land in that field? We'll take a break now and return with a Herald and Review shortly.